Hey, this is Porter Howell with Little Texas, and you're listening to the Neon Eon.
Hey, y'all, I'm Thomas Mooney, and as Porter just said, you're listening to the Neon Eon. It's been a pretty great month here at the Neon Eon, and we're closing it out being joined by Porter Howell of the band Little Texas. Porter has been the longtime guitarist for Little Texas and one of the band's chief songwriters from the get-go. When Little Texas reformed back in the mid-2000s, he took over the band's lead vocalist duties as well. One of the things that I absolutely love about the Neon Eon, this era of music, is that there were these country bands, and not just vocal groups or duos, actual bands. And that's part of what made Little Texas so dynamic back in the day. Back in their heyday, they had six members, and incredibly, they had three guys on lead vocal duties. Now that was primarily Tim Rushlow and Brady Seals sharing those lead vocals, but as pointed out during this interview, Dwayne O'Brien also got in the act a time or two. And that is something that you rarely see these days. And of course, when you're that multi-talented, an added bonus is just how stellar the vocal harmonies were within the band. That was undoubtedly a calling card for Little Texas, especially on hits like My Love, Kick a Little, Amy's Back in Austin, the incredible What Might Have Been, and so many others. We talk about a lot of the origin stories behind a lot of those songs and recording those early records and what it was like to be a band during this time and so much more on this one. Before we get started though, be sure to go ahead and subscribe to the Neon Eon, share it with your friends and family. With this one, we'll have four episodes under our belt. And if you haven't checked out the previous three just yet, they're with Clay Walker, Pam Tillis, and Gretchen Peters. Go ahead, listen to those after this one right here. If you're on iTunes, I'd appreciate a five-star review. And in that review, go ahead, share who you think needs to make a Neon Eon appearance. We'll see what we can do. And for more Neon Eon conversations, be sure to give a like and a follow on all the social media platforms. I'll throw links into the show notes, of course, but we're at the Neon Eon over on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you want to join the Patreon for even more Neon Eon stuff, I'll throw that link into the show notes as well. All right, let's do it. Here is Porter Howell of Little Texas. With you is, you know, you're from Texas and you grew up here, obviously, and, you know, you make it up to Nashville. What was, I guess, like the, a little bit more of that origin story of you making it up to Nashville? Was that like the first place right out of high school that you were wanting to get to, or was there a little bit more of a, was it just like a straight shot there for you, I guess?
It actually was. I graduated and turned 19 that summer from high school and had already chosen Belmont University at the time. No, Belmont College at the time. Now it's Belmont University. Little small, you know, back then, Baptist college with 2,000 kids, but was known for a music business school, and actually found out about it from Mark Bright, who, I mean, just to throw out one thing, he's done a whole lot, produces Carrie Underwood. So he's actually from Longview and had found Belmont. And then through some of his teachers, my teachers found out about it and told, you know, several of us. It was actually three or four of us that came up here in the early 80s based on Mark's knowledge of, you know, that Belmont existed. So, yeah, right out of high school, straight to Nashville.
Yeah, what was that like? I guess what I've heard mainly from some of the previous guests that I've talked with is, you know, like that the Nashville was a little bit quote unquote smaller back then, obviously, but it was a little bit more, was it easy to break into the music scene as far as making connections and everything? Or was that just like, how difficult was that early on back in those early days?
I can only speak for me. And looking back, I was just extremely lucky or just made good decisions or whatever. But I didn't, I've always given the advice to anybody that has the means to, especially if they're young enough, to come here and try to go to Belmont. or even MTSU, because, you know, I didn't live in my car. There's those stories. I didn't knock on doors and all that. The Belmont afforded such an opportunity to meet people that would eventually be in the business. You know, the way I can look back on it now is that Doug Grau and Christy DiNapoli and some other friends got in the business side of it, and I was just the guitar player they chose to use for their projects, you know? And so it really is, I say, it's not who you know, like as far as you, who you rubbed elbows with at a party, but for me, it was who I met in college and became close with because they knew me and trusted me and, you know, knew what I was all about because we'd spent a lot of time together, you know, and we're good friends. So I almost feel guilty speaking to how hard it was or not to make it in Nashville, because Belmont was such a, almost a shortcut, I guess is the way to say that.
Yeah. I think, like, you know, part of the college experience is always just having those connections. And I feel like you can probably apply that to any industry, but being, I guess, kind of connected to the music industry and journalism, obviously, man, just having that Rolodex of people that you can call upon is just kind of essential.
Yeah. And you're also, I mean, I used to joke, we were at, when Warner Brothers was in a house on Division, I had been in Nashville for less than a year, and we would go in after hours because Christy, who was our manager, he was an intern there. So through Belmont, he gets an internship at Warner Brothers. We find ourselves at after hours at Warner Brothers at 10 o'clock at night calling our parents because it was, we would charge it to them. We would call from the Warner Brothers. I mean, where do, if I'd have stayed in Longview, Texas, I wouldn't have gotten that experience where you're, that's just a way to say I was literally in the building, you know? And so that rubs off on you. You just go, oh man, this is how it really works. You know, I'm hearing the stories from one of my best friends who's an intern that says, you know, you don't even realize that you're getting an indoctrination to how this stuff really goes down. You know, so it's really invaluable. It ups your game. You think, oh boy, this is how it really is. You either go home or learn it and stay with it, you know?
Yeah. Like it seems that, you know, when you move to a place like Nashville, there is something to that whole iron sharpens iron. You're going to have to like jump on that treadmill that's already running and kind of up your game. And also, you know, just kind of catch up and, everything that's involved with that. I guess like how early on, like when you know you're going to college and you're going and playing on these projects, but also you're in the belly of the beast. I feel like there's this really interesting juxtaposition there where it does feel like you're trying to break into the industry, but you also have a little bit of runway because you are in school. Is that fair to say?
Yes, very much so. And that's what I tell people. You've got 4 years or maybe more or maybe less in my case because I dropped out to just be there. And like I said, you're not living in your car. You're not really paying rent if college is taken care of like it was for me. Thank goodness because of my family. But, you know, you're eating a 99-cent soup bar at Shoney's with your friends, but you're not roughing it, you know, and you've got those 4 years to meet people and find out how it really works. How you're being taught, you're taking classes that are teaching you, you know, you're not going to apply that word for word or anything. But like I said before, it just enlightens you to the way things really work. Copyright, management, touring, sound reinforcement. It's all right there. And you're with a bunch of music bones that sleep, eat, and live it constantly. So you're with your peers that are doing it too. And it's just an incredible opportunity to learn and definitely sharpen and figure it out, you know?
Mm-hmm. You've touched on something there about, you know, like the, it being a little bit smaller. And of course, like during the late 90s, you really just saw a lot of like, I guess, the industry being built up or bought up by corporate America in a lot of ways. And that obviously you can tap that into the radio and just like everything that's attached to the business. What was it like, I guess, kind of those early days, knowing that it was a little bit more, for lack of a better term, a little bit more mom and pop versus how seeing that transition to it being where all of a sudden it is a little bit more suit and tie?
Of course, I can only do that in hindsight, because when we were signed to Warner Brothers, it was anything but suit and tie. But I didn't realize, you know, you don't realize at that point how ma and pa it really was. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed a little scary. And I remember James Stroud, who co-produced our stuff off, well, three of the four records. James was huge. I don't know if y'all know that name, but at the time he was, you know, producing Clint Black, and hell, he was producing Larry Morgan, Clint Black, and like 30 other acts, and eventually ran Giant Records. So he was this guy that had been there, done that. And that's kind of why he was part of our team. And this is in those days, in like maybe 89, 90, we were getting ready to record our first sides, and he came to a rehearsal. And James said, "Boys, tomorrow you take Warner Brothers, think about it, the bunny, the whole thing, you take Warner Brothers money to make a competitive record to try to break into this industry." He said, "After tomorrow, you will be competing with Van Halen and Madonna for the label's attention." And, you know, and it was like, that's a scary thought. But I always quote that as, bam, you realize right then, man, well, this has been my dream, in quotation marks, but this is their business, and I'm a product. They love me and they take me to sushi that I pay for later. But, they, you know, this is the real deal, man. And so it felt not formal, because I never saw our people wear anything but shorts and swag, you know. Everybody at Warner Brothers wore something they got for free, it seemed like. You know, so it definitely wasn't suit and all that, like I said. But to me, it got formal. So I know you're going to ask about the whole career, but fast forward to towards the end of our run, and we were used to that. We were used to how the business ran, and we went to that house on Division and had catfish dinners and all that with everybody and knew them well and became family. In 96, when they passed the Consolidation Act and let corporations own a huge number of stations, everybody knows about, when Clear Channel stepped in and all that, you could feel it. You could see it. It was like, who are these guys with name tags with suits, you know? And it literally became even more that you were a product and that you were very expendable, and that mainly it felt like they were about to become very corporate with how they chose material, how they chose what they were going to play and what they weren't. And it didn't feel like they cared about your cred, because they weren't coming from that ma and pa country thing, and the when country radio stations were actually ma and pa and competing with the rock stations. They knew that they were about to put all that under one roof, and it was all going to change drastically. It's like, don't get me started on that. That's one of my main soapboxes, is how the, I'm not normally an anti-corporation or anything like that, but it really tweaked the music business in a drastic way, and it doesn't get talked about very much, how that changed things.
Yeah, we've touched a little bit on that in the previous episodes, where you did have the more regionalism, and that meant both on like the radio station kind of way, where it felt like these regional markets had more of their fingerprint on what they were playing and what were chosen as singles. Like you could have like a song that was played by a specific market, where it may have charted in the 50s because that specific market loved that song. And it was a little bit more like that. And then also on the other side of things, where the artistry was a little bit more diverse, because it felt like there was a lot of different kind of things happening, as far as, you know, you had like more of the California country stuff from like Dwight Yoakam. And then we had like, you know, hillbilly rock, Marty Stewart. You had more of the balladry kind of people. You had, you know what I'm saying? Like there was a lot more diversity, I felt, back in those days.
As you just said, and if one of the things that one or two or three companies buying up every station did was narrow that down, because you've got less regionality like you're talking about, and it's being programmed from some central hub, you know, in Dallas or wherever. And yeah, there's less consideration for all that. It became like, oh, this is what we play right here. This is what researches well, regardless of who does it. So all of a sudden, Alan Jackson's doing what Alan Jackson's doing, but that record's two country or whatever, when 5 years before it was the thing, you know. You definitely lost. I say that all the time. You had country music, but you had just what you just said. You had Southern Rock, Lynyrd Skynyrd from Travis Tritt. You had the Eagles from us and Diamond Rio. You had Dwight Yoakam doing his Bakersfield thing and the clean voice country honky tonk with Pete Anderson getting to play what he played, you know. And it almost overnight, it seemed like, nope, those fringes were cut off, because whoever's programming it, the music is more trained to hear a narrower, you know, product, basically, instead of respecting the history and all the diversity within the genre, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what I've kind of picked up on as far as like looking back on the 90s has been this thing where, you know, one of the bigger, I guess, movements was, especially early on, was like the neo-traditional stuff, where you had a lot of people pulling back from, you know, stuff from the 60s and 70s. And then you had a lot of newer artists also like pushing forward in a more progressive way. Looking back, like, is that something that you even realize that's happening in the moment? Or is that just something where, you know, when you look back 20 years, you know, that you go, oh, you know, there was actually some kind of movement happening here. And there were some really interesting things that were happening that were both, again, like playing towards tradition, but also like stepping into the future.
I was definitely aware of it, because at Belmont and throughout trying to get the Warner Brothers deal going in the mid to late 80s, there was what they called the great cred scare, if you've already called that, of the 80s. And that's what we were about, man. I mean, Foster and Lloyd was it to me. Christy, who I mentioned earlier, our manager, actually knew Radney from the MTM days when he was a writer there and stuff, and knew some of the guys behind the scenes. And so I hadn't met Radney yet, but man, that Steve Earle, the O'Kanes, Roseanne Cash, Rodney Crowell, Amy Lou Harris. You might not hear that in Little Texas music, but that's what drew us so hard to it. You know, it got really cool there for a second, and you could definitely feel that. And so, whether you say it a lot or actually hear it in our music, that informed us big time. It's like, you can do this. You know, it doesn't have to be traditional necessarily. And in our day, you could definitely feel a wave, a momentum. We were in Dallas playing clubs in 89 during our development period before our record came out. It was exciting, man. There were young people. There was a bar in North Dallas called Borrowed Money. I don't know if any of your other people have talked about that, but they probably have played there. Ty Herndon played there. Jim Collins, who wrote a bunch of huge hits, was one of the house bands there. I know Toby went through there. You could feel that country was going younger, and that there were nice BMWs in the parking lot and girls with leather skirts, which was different than I say that to say that it was different than the honky tonk thing. You know, it was starting to be the cool thing to do. You know, Troy Aikman used to come into that club. So it was hip and now and not hay bale, you know? Yeah. And that had a lot to do with, oh boy, we're on the right part of this. You know, you wake up morning, I tell people, I wake up one morning and think, who in the hell are we kidding trying to make it? You know, this ain't ever going to come through. And then the next morning I wake up going, man, we are right in the right place at the right time, and this is going to happen. You know, So yeah, you could feel it getting younger and hipper, and it was an exciting time.
Yeah, I would encourage everyone to go and check out that album art of that first record that y'all released. And
that is like,
yeah, you guys had a lot of hair going on.
We did. And the night before that shoot, I don't know about the album cover, but Dale Gray, our drummer, in the meeting said to the publicity head of Warner Brothers, Janice Azright, thinking about wearing bicycle shorts and boots. And he, ha, ha, ha. And she goes, cool, do it. Because she kind of knew what we were about. And boy, he regrets that. Because to this day, he's 50 years old, and people say, wear the bicycle shorts.
Yeah.
My advice to my kids with fashion and stuff, because my daughter is in musical theater and is starting to be a young singer-songwriter as well. I say, don't ever bite too hard into anyone fat. Look at these pictures. Don't buy in too hard to any trend, you know?
Oh yeah, I know. That's yeah. I think anyone does this where you kind of look back at, you know, your parents, and you know, like my parents were, you know, in their 20s and 30s in the late 80s and 90s. And sometimes I'm just going like, Mom, what was this that you're wearing? You know, but yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy. A few of us actually worked at Opryland USA. So going back to how I tell people to get to Nashville, that was the other thing, except for it's not there anymore. But I was in an 80s. Well, I was in sort of a music review, like a 30-minute show in the Jukebox Theater that had been 50s music. By the time we got there, there was a review and we didn't have to wear 50s stuff. You know, didn't have to slick your hair back and do all that stuff. But we wore 80s clothes because we thought they were hip. And you talk about, and somebody posted on Facebook like last week. And I'm like, please stop. No, mullets and those clothes from Chess King. Remember that in the mall?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what were we thinking? Playing 50s music with a pointy headstock, Charvel, Eddie Van Halen guitar, and 80s clothes. I tell my kids, never bite too hard.
You know, something else that was happening back then, and it's one of those things where there was bands, there was country bands happening back in the 80s and 90s. And you don't, now I'm sure like someone's going to come in here and give me all the exceptions to the rule later on if they comment on this episode, but back then there was a lot of identifiable bands and there was some diversity within those bands, of course, too. What was, you know, like, what was that like as far as having some peers where they were, you guys were bands like you guys and of course like Blackhawk and Diamond Rio and, you know, going even a little bit further back, Alabama. What was it like having at least some contemporaries, some peers that were in that way as well, and not necessarily just solo artists?
That's a great question, because it's a different animal being in a band. You're an artist, but you're not the single person. So the drummer might not get recognized at a mall or whatever. You know, it's an in-between dynamic for a musician, because you're not a side guy. You are the act, but you're also not the act. And so we were in a club back then that I think you're right. I mean, if you were to go stickler about it and old school like me, you're not a band if you don't have a drummer. That's what I say. So what they call bands now are duos and trios, and no disrespect to that. It's I get it. I know exactly why, at least in my opinion, it's like that. But so all that to say, we had a camaraderie with those guys for sure, the healthy competition with the Diamond Rios. And Great Plains and a lot of these bands that didn't really take real well, but we knew really well from the radio circuit and all that. It was a blast to hang out with those guys because you just get it. You understand what being a band is like as opposed to being a solo artist, you know. really good, cool time. Bands are hard. You have all these different personalities, and there's not a point person. So you have six people, and the label doesn't know who to call. Or somebody who normally doesn't make the calls, like a bass player or a drummer. No disrespect for bass players and drummers. Is calling the label saying, hey, how come we didn't get this and that? And you know what I mean? It's like managing six people, six artists at once, all in one. All wanting something different sometimes. And, of course, this is generally speaking. The publishing writing issue is tough on bands. Managing a band is really hard. Signing a band is hard. So a lot of it, and marketing a band, trying to get the public to buy into the depth of the band and not just the lead singer. So it's like, well, why not just have the guy, you know, or a guy and one other girl and a guy to focus on rather than having to iron five, six, you know, kind of the ambiguity, but that's the way to say the word, of a band, fell out of favor of having to market that. And it's just cleaner to go with duos and trios, I think, from a business standpoint and marketing, you know, getting it out there to the public.
Right. Yeah. There's, it's that thing that you said about, like, you know, who does the label reach out to? There's almost like that, just by nature, that diffusion of responsibility of almost like, who's that, like you said, who's the point man? Who's the person who you need to contact? And that's just one of those little things that I don't know if we necessarily even think about. And now, like, on the other side, like hey, you mentioned the songwriting aspect. That's maybe one of the big added bonuses of having a band, is having a place where songs can come from multiple people and having a little bit more, you know, people giving out ideas. You were always, you know, a principal writer of the band. And of course, like there's a lot of the band all wrote together. You, of course, were a big part of that. Was there, like, you know, I guess, like, what was that like early on, being that lead guitar player and not necessarily being, like, you know, the lead vocalist until much later? What was that like as far as being that lead guitar player and not necessarily, you know, singing those songs?
I like that better. I'm grateful to have been able to front the band, and it's kept us touring, and it's the four of us get along great, and it's a tight little, well, you got a place for us to play, we show up, and we've been functional for 18 years, you know. But I'm a guitar player. I like stage right. In my own world, I should go apologize to Rush Lowe, you know, probably about being hard on him, like when his voice hurt or whatever, because now I get it. Or when he couldn't hear and he'd say, turn the guitar down. It was like, no, we did the whole battle. Now I do that, you know, with myself. You know, I'm the lead guitar player and the singer. But as far as that, it was my role and I was good with it. That I think a lot of people that know us personally are surprised that I stepped out front and, you know, can talk to audiences and all that, because I was kind of like the shy one that just ran around a bunch. And, you know, they'd give me a microphone and I'd forget to go to it to sing my ooh and my ah. I'd look over and be five guys frowning at me like, dude, you forgot your one line. But okay, because you only give me one line. But definitely the guitar. Guitar's first for me. And then I learned to write out of necessity. And then I sang out of survival. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. Well, like, how did a lot of those early songs, you know, like, I know every song's kind of a different thing whenever, you know, it's written, and they all kind of come in different ways. But did a lot of those early songs come in the form of, you know, you guys just kind of playing around, or you picking on guitar, and then kind of what was, like, I guess, like the dynamics of those early songs and the songwriting of those songs?
That's a great question too. We had a developmental deal on Warner Brothers as we put the band together. So the aforementioned Christy Znapoli and Doug Grau had worked at Warner Brothers. Doug was working at Warner Brothers. So we had the luxury of, we weren't put together. We were already together. Four of us were already together, and we got the other two. But we had a developmental deal from the start. The very first stuff we cut was five outside songs written by writers you'd recognize. Turn it in, nothing. Weren't impressed. There was nothing special there. Sound too much like Restless Heart and Exile kind of thing, you know? The songs didn't connect with us. So the powers that be turned to us and said, start writing. You know, I've heard, they had heard some stuff we had done, but not seriously. And everybody, write. And so early on, Duane O'Brien and I kind of sparked a relationship and were able to write the first things that made sense, I think. So they put us together. Like when you guys go from Atlanta to Dallas next time, O'Brien and Porter are in the van together. And y'all write and talk about writing, listen to music together. So we did all that and started just writing in all of our spare time out on the road because we were playing clubs 6 nights a week. And sure enough, we turned in some stuff that they went, yeah. Because the stuff we were getting was too old, you know? We were an average age of like 21. So we were getting Alabama songs that they had turned down that just did not make sense for what we were about. Didn't fit the image and all that. So the writing came out of you guys do it. And it became a lot of fun at first. It was exciting to actually try it and be coming up with things that they liked, you know. A lot of plotting and scheming. That's close. Nah, you have to have tough skin, man. You can't get your feelings hurt. No, you know, you get a lot of that. And then you come back. Duane had that, we would come up, you know, right like you do in Nashville. A lot of it was written from titles. We'd overhear somebody say something. Duane just came up with a twist on the phrase, some guys have all the luck, and said, some guys have all the love. You know, we got nothing going, but I got a cool girlfriend kind of thought, you know. And he and I wrote that in a blue van, shoved full of equipment, going from Denver to Fort Worth. And started it and wrote the chorus and then wrote the verses later. So that's a snippet of what it was like, you know, hotel rooms, sound checks, messing around with, like you said, musical ideas and thoughts. And eventually Brady became a write with me. He has a cred. He comes from a family full of famous people and great writers. He was very young at the time, but then he started in on it. So the three of us, just any chance we could we'd be in autograph lines throwing out lines and ideas, you know, during those times.
Yeah, like it's always interesting to see how, you know, especially when you're starting out so early, you know, playing those 6 nights a week, being out on the road and trying to carve out time to write. Because as you know, there's only X amount of hours in the day, and there's only, and it's filled up with driving, and it's filled up with loading in and loading out and playing and eating. And then all of a sudden, like, you realize like, oh man, we don't have like any time to write. And it's always interesting to see how a band figures out how to utilize that time in the van.
We would get ideas at radio station visits, and like I said, autograph lines, and somebody would say something and we'd lean over to the other guy, you know, four guys down in the line, say, hey, dude, did you hear that? Yep, I heard that. Write it down. And so all of that happened in that state of, I tell people back then, man, I don't know how it is now, but when you got something going, like when we had a hit, your life was, that was it. You were going all the time. And I remember getting put kind of in a lower state of awareness almost for 10 years. You were at a different, but that sort of brain drunk, ah, where am I now? Kind of was great for coming up with the initial spark, I think. So we would have a backlog of like 20 titles and bits and pieces that we couldn't finish on the back of a bus with all the noise and guys coming in and out and and all the craziness. But then once we had those ideas, we'd get back in town and meet to finish them, or meet, hey, tomorrow at 10, everybody, you're getting up early and you're meeting me in my room, and we're actually working on this. You know what I mean? So the beginning would come in all this chaos and borrowed time. And, you know, not the, I remember writing part of Kick a Little on an airplane across the aisle with O'Brien, but we got together later and formally finished it, you know? So that's just how we operated.
Yeah. Like just being aware enough to, you know, pull those things out of the sky and make sure you wrote them down and had them for later. That's always, you know, a key to all of that. What I find really interesting is, and refreshing, is that, you know, your people encourage y'all to write, you know, also all too often it can be the other way around, of trying to get more outside songs. And it feels like they really pushed y'all into, you know, coming up with your own material.
They did. It was an incredible time for that. Alan Jackson wrote most of his stuff. Clint wrote everything with his guitar player. Travis wrote most of his stuff. And there are definitely great writers out there right now that have deals because they're great writers. So mm-hmm. it's still a thing. But yeah, especially in bands, I think you were, it was just kind of considered, these dudes have been playing these clubs aren't the kind of writers that we have in Nashville. You know, so we're going to get more professional, competitive hit songs from the Brain Trust there, which is true. But like I said, we didn't fit that. We just weren't hearing it. So I listened to our first record. It's so naive. It's so beautifully naive, man. We didn't know what we were doing, but it's awesome because it is different. It is us. It's us figuring it out, you know. And so I really appreciate that they let us do that, not just from a, you know, monetary standpoint, but just creatively. I think it really made us. And whether the public knew it or not, there was a certain appeal there because we had written these naive little songs, you know.
Yeah.
And survived the process, basically.
Yeah. Was there ever any of, not necessarily pressure or anything like that, but was there any ever where they would stick you all in a room with someone else who was a more veteran songwriter, or just another songwriter in general?
Well, that's something I kind of left out. That was there from the very beginning. And we didn't cut a whole lot of those songs, but man, did they help us write on our own. We learned so much. It's another thing of, you don't understand what all goes into it until you sit across from somebody who's been doing it for 10 years and has 10 hits under his belt, you know? It's like you can't help but soak up how they think about it, what they draw from, what the process is like. So in 89, I think, I wrote with Stuart Harris, had written hits for Travis. Our Brain Trust was responsible for Travis, too, and set me up with Stuart. We wrote You Forever and Me on our first attempt, and it was our third single, and it went to number 5. So there were examples of that outside writing helped, but it was with one of us saying, no, I can't say that, you know, no, that's too old. No, we're young. Think Eagles, you know? So we would help them shape what we needed. And they love that. I like it to this day. Love writing with young artists who know who they are and what they want to do. And then you help them facilitate that. So yeah, that, we might not have, and to sum all that up, we might not have cut a whole lot of outside songs, but we were, all of us wrote with outside people. And I still appreciate them, you know, giving us that time and teaching me how to do it.
Yeah. You mentioned Some Guys Have All the Love, that being like your first, y'all's first single. Do you remember like the first time you heard it on the radio, like outside of, you know, like a radio interview or something
yeah.
like that?
Yeah, outside of them having to play it because we were sitting there with Warner Brothers reps. Yeah. I believe. And, you know, these days, it was like 30 years ago, so getting to be. So you guys disagree, but I think it was or have different, the wrong town or the right town or whatever. I want to say we were leaving Wichita Falls after like a radio gig. So technically we weren't in the station, and they had officially added the song to their playlist. And we were leaving town in a van still in those days, and they played Some Guys. And I think we pulled over and freaked out. It was just like that scene in That Thing You Do, where they all go in the record store and freak out and go. That scene brings tears to my eyes, because that's literally what it was like. Like, holy shit, we just heard our song on the radio, you know. Fast forward to when it was a top five song. We had taken two bands and radio guys and maybe Christy to Memphis. For some reason, Vandy was playing, I don't know if they were playing Memphis or what, but no, backwards. We were in Memphis recording our first record, but Some Guys was a hit. We came back to Nashville to sing the national anthem at a Vanderbilt football game. And going back the other way, one band pulls next to the other one, rolls down the window, radio, and they're playing Some Guys. The other van goes, yeah, they are. And we realized, because they were so loud and both fans were like, you know, risking our lives here doing this, we realized it was both of the main Nashville radio stations playing the song at the same time, just coincidentally. So that was the moment we said, shit, we got a hit. You know, this is a big song.
Yeah.
On both stations.
Yeah, you mentioned how that first record, you know, you look back on it now and you go, it's, how did you say? You said it was naively beautiful, right? Something like that.
Yeah.
You know, what was that like cutting that first record? Can you expand a little bit more on that description?
Yeah, we had been playing most of the songs on that album. We've been playing in our set. So Rodney Crowell song, Restless Heart song, Exile song, Alabama song, One of Ours. And the trick was to keep people dancing, you know, and see how it blended and just feel, hey, is this as good? Is this fit with this, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So those songs were kind of ready. This is most of everything we had. And we've actually been working it into sets and knew it live. Warner Brothers gave us money for the third time. And two times they had rejected us in the course of a year and a half. The third time, Some Guys was one of those four songs. They said, okay, we'll release something. They gave us $20,000 for a video, which back then was nothing. And basically thought, you know, we'll shut these guys up and just put this out here and see if it works. Well, it goes to 6 on all the charts and on both radio stations at once and all that stuff. And they turn to us and say, where the hell's the record? So we go into Memphis, which was part of our team's way. We were never at home, and we didn't have cell phones back then, and we would scatter because we were trying to live a life. You know, at that point, we were looking for houses and getting married and, you know, in our young 20s, and we were on the road so much that when you got us in Nashville, we were hard to find, even if we were making a record. So they kind of sequestered us in Memphis, and it was also because we wanted to be able to just block out a studio that wasn't quite as expensive as in Nashville and live in it. So we went to Arden, which is famous for like ZZ Top and Lynyrd Skynyrd and a guy named John Hardy, John Hampton, who produced the Gin Blossoms, passed away recently, was our engineer there, and he had worked on the Travis Tritt thing. And so he was our engineer. We cut some of that record in Nashville, but most of it was sessions in Memphis. It was just a blast, man. It was very exciting. We struggled through it because we didn't use studio musicians. We had to learn to play to a click. We had to learn to make a whole album worth of competitive music and get our ideas down. Tones, I struggled with guitar tones. Man, I had one amp and an out-of-tune, not intonated guitar that I'd beat the hell out of on the road, you know? Mm-hmm. So talk about naive. There was it just surviving it, but having a ball too. We weren't a big band, so we would cut basic tracks and get basic. The whole idea was to cut the band live. So that wouldn't work. We'd strip it all down to drums, and then Probst would play his part, get that tight. And then I would spend hours and hours layering guitars and doing stuff. And then Brady, and then sang. And so we had this whole process. We lived at a hotel down the street from Arden, ate at TGI Fridays and drank there every day. And we would spend 2 and 3 weeks there at a time, go do some dates and come back. I think we did that 2 or 3 times. And then came out with the Warner Brothers album, got a really good record deal because we already had a hit before they signed the contract, you know. Mm-hmm. So we were able to negotiate for a better deal than the baby deal. And I think even First Time for Everything was our second single. I think it had run its course or was at least out before we even released, you know, had the album finished. So it was an exciting time.
Yeah, that's also one of those things that you don't necessarily think about where, you know, you guys are essentially road dogs out there playing road shows on the road constantly. And then, of course, going into the studio is just an entirely different beast. And there's things that obviously can apply to both, but, you know, there's things that you learn out on the road that are just specific for those honky-tonks and those bars and, you know, the live element. And you can't necessarily do that in the studio. And you got to not necessarily reprogram, but in some ways you got to adapt to that setting as well.
Yeah. That is precisely why James Stroud was part of what we did. Because essentially Christy and Doug that co-produced the records were young music professionals that didn't have a track record. They worked their asses off. I mean, they put in the hours. One more time, one more time, one more time. You know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. No, man, that's not good. They fought with each other over creative, you know, choices and all that, and how to handle us and all that. So it was very real in the trenches. But James brought a sense of, I'm not going to let this be a waste of time and money to it. You know, kind of an executive overseer. He was running a label. So he wasn't there 24/7, but he was there a lot, and he helped with big issues and just kind of oversee the whole thing and brought a professional element to it, you know, yeah. and tied it all together.
Yeah, just kind of having that veteran voice because, you know, yeah. again, that track record. You know, like that, by the time that second record comes out, that's just like a year later. How much more comfortable were y'all cutting that record?
Very much. By then, we were starting to get the gear right and all that stuff. Again, we had written most of the songs. I think James was actually in Memphis a little more. It was definitely a more comfortable process. So a little more pressure. But one of the things that we had was a couple songs that we believed in, and they were What Might Have Been and God Bless Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually finished What Might Have Been a few weeks before, maybe a couple months before the first record came out. So we had, that was road tested. We'd been playing it with just me on acoustic. So the only issue was how to make it a record. We just didn't think it would get airplay with just me on a guitar. So we added bass and drums and some strings, but having the confidence of that material helped, I think. You know, we weren't sure it was a hit, but we had a good idea, you know. And yeah, more experience with the process, more experience with John Hampton, who's just an incredibly patient person. Having Hampton was a little different than the Nashville thing, too. He was willing to try anything, you know. It wasn't on a clock, necessarily. He would dig out old amplifiers and do all this stuff. And that ramped up during that second album process.
Yeah. That you mentioned, obviously, What Might Have Been. That was such a big, you know, power ballad moment for y'all. And there was some crossover success with that song. I guess, like, was that one of those things where you guys also were you guys surprised that it had some appeal to, you know, outside, quote unquote, country markets?
When we wrote it, we didn't know what the hell it was. You know, is this pop? Is it that song is one of the most pure Little Texas songs you'd ever hear, and honest. Meaning, we did write that in one sitting in the back of a bus on a trip. It fell into our laps. The three of us brought the guys in that night. Everybody had been drinking, you know, of course, on back of the bus. We're going from opening for Clint Black in Vegas back to kind of our hub in Dallas. And or Oklahoma, I think. And it just fell out. And we know, you know what I mean? Writing it, there was no, this is pop or this is too country or is this going to be this or this. Just, we just wrote it how, with our sensibilities and how, however it needed to be written, you know. And all in one sitting, worked up the vocals that night, played it the next day in Oklahoma. And, yeah, we knew, you know, is that, you had a good idea because of the response, but we were a little concerned just commercially about that it would fit into to country radio and had no idea that it would be a straight pop or a AC thing, you know, but knew that it was a universal appeal, you know, very organic, no steel guitar, no real stamps of any one format, just a song. I tell you what makes that song work is everybody's got a What Might Have Been.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, if you look at the comments right now on YouTube, which wasn't a thing then, they don't talk about the song or anything. They say, oh, I remember her. We weren't together in high school and we couldn't be together. Yeah, it's just that lyric transcended any kind of genre that the song would be in, I think.
Yeah, that's really interesting because as far as you guys kind of knowing that you had something there, but also being, you know, a little concerned about like where it fit. And I think a lot of artists have that. They have that one or those one or two songs where, you know, they know they have something, they're excited about it, but they're not sure how it's going to be taken. And then of course, because it is special, the audience finds it and they demand it.
Right. We had a little bit of a thing with that song. We had released, You Forever, and then a song that didn't do that well, just kind of a mediocre thing called What Were You Thinking? That was our lowest charting single. And then we did another waltz ballad, Rather Miss You. The label hears and the promotion staff hears the finished album of Big Time and says, What Might Have Been Your Single? I remember my stomach sinking, thinking, no, 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 no. Yes, it's a hit. No, not now. Not next. And I said it in a meeting, you know, what say we did have. They listened to us. I said, you know, I just mean they're going to be sluggish on this. And we had George Briner, who still works for the Big Machine, for Borchetta and them, said, no, this, you go with your best song. Who cares what you had last? This song is a smash. So we put it out there. And the first couple of weeks, we got ads, but it's sluggish. I was like, you just killed a great song. And then about week three or four, it just exploded in certain markets. And then Briner turned to me and said, see, you put out your best song. And so, you know, I think the sluggishness was from, God, this is a ballad band or what? It's a bunch of long-haired young rocker dudes doing all these ballads. What's the, and then the audience heard it and it was all over.
Yeah. Well, was there anything about, you know, maybe like the concern of being that ballad band where did you guys push or lean the other way as well to ensure that people knew that you guys could write more like, you know, country rock, kind of Southern rock stuff? Perfect example, of course, God Bless Texas.
Yeah. The plain fact of it was that we could not write. We struggled with writing tempo that wasn't silly. That's the only way I know to put it. We'd have things that just weren't hits. They didn't fit. So it was always tempo, tempo, tempo. When the band was done, I was staff writer, the whole mantra was up tempo positive. It was just hard to do, man. We would write them, but they just weren't the ones. So you go in with your best songs. You go with My Love was an afterthought. It just barely made the record, you know. But it was such a radio tempo and feel for back then. It was easier to play that than the tempo we were coming up with. God Bless Texas was, I tell people this all the time, it seems like such a no-brainer now. There was some resistance big time within the Brain Trust. But once we got it And then we get out there and big hit. Then they turn to us and say, write another one. Okay, okay. We try and try and try. And just, it's hard, man. That's where Kick a Little came from, you know. To this day, I wish we had two more up-tempo, big, big singles, you know, for the show. So the short answer to that whole thing is we knew we needed it. It was just difficult to come up with. In writer's nights, around here, like the Bluebirds, I used to just launch into God Bless, hey, you know this one, sing along, launch into God Bless Texas. And then I thought, poor little song, it's done so much. And I never brag on it because it's my closer. And so at one time last year, I said, hey, I'm going to stop and set this song up. And just went on and on. George Bush used it in his when he was elected governor of Texas. It's been in every sports thing in Texas. It opens Six Flags over the speakers. State Fair, same thing. It is the Texas Motor Speedway theme song thing. It has been on True Blood, Texas Cheerleader Murders, like all these different shows and movies. And, you know, it's been incredible that that song's had the reach that it has, you know. It makes sense now to use it for everything in Texas, but it's still very cool that they do. American Idol was using it every time they went to Dallas. They used it as the open to the show.
Yeah, like it's just one of those things that's, if you're from Texas, you just get it. And like, it's, like I said, it feels like it's been around forever.
Yeah.
And then if you're not from Texas, like I know like there's people out there that you just kind of feel a little bit of jealousy that there's that Texan pride right there. Yeah.
Right. So I think that was back then, Texas and A&M were both in the Big 12.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some concern about that. I remember thinking, I don't know if this is going to be a hit single in Arkansas. Don't they hate our guts, you know? And it worked the opposite. They loved it because it was the Big 12, and they were part of that. And, you know, Texas has such a universal appeal, you know,
yeah,
that it was no worry. Next thing we know, we're in Alaska, and they're screaming, God bless Texas, and all over Canada, you know, and they love it, so.
Yeah, so you mentioned the Eagles a little bit further back, and I think like one of those records that just was an incredible record, and that is for like the 90s, and that's that Common Thread record. You guys were on mm-hmm. that, and of course that features a lot of the big hitters of the day, you know, covering the Eagles. How did you all get involved with that?
James. Again, I think that's a little bit to do with Stroud was part of Giant, and they did the record.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you're one of the only people I've ever heard mention that. We were the baby act of those names, and that really helped with our run with Big Time because we were associated with Travis, Clint, and Allen, and, you know, on that record, and it was such a big deal, such a big buzz in 94. There was the CMA Album of the Year, and we were on it. So, again, our names get put out there. The association was incredible for us. We actually cut Already Gone first.
Oh, really?
And kind of it made more sense, huh? A rock kind of thing, and we messed it up. And it wasn't that great. And I'd say, you know, hold my hand up on that. I don't feel like I did that real well back then. And then just kind of missed it. And Tanya Tucker had done it too, and they didn't know. It's what we got. I don't know if she replaced us or what, but I think they just accidentally let two acts record the same song. So we rushed in the studio real quick, and we were scattered, like I was talking about earlier. So they said, hey, we're doing this because this is too big of an opportunity. Whoever wants to come back from wherever the hell you are, come back. So Brady made it back, I think. Probst didn't play on it. We got Denny Bigsby from Great Plains to play bass. Rushlow was gone somewhere, so Brian sang. I think that's why he did it. But we knew his voice would fit Peaceful Easy Feeling. So we scraped that together, and it was just all really good fortune, you know, that we didn't do Already Gone, that we did change to Peaceful, that O'Brien sang, made it the third singer that we had that had a charted record. Because Peaceful charted out what you were saying way back, just radio stations playing it because they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we never released it formally. But.
Now, I was going to want to ask about this because I kind of fell down that rabbit hole. You mentioned music videos and everything like that, and this is one of those things I did not remember. It was, you know, something I didn't remember for 20 years or so. And then I was watching this morning, like I said, the rabbit hole of music videos, and you guys had cut a song with Jeff Foxworthy on the Party
Online. Oh, yeah.
And what? How did you guys get involved with that? Like, what was that? What's the story behind all that?
One of our producers, Doug Grau, who was our A&R man at Warner Brothers, had was responsible for Foxworthy. It was his act. You know, he was their Jeff's A&R person. I think Doug had a big thing to do with helping to come up with the idea to UCMT to expose Jeff's comedy, mm-hmm. you know, and put him and do those videos. So we were label mates with connections, and that was one of those touring like crazy. Hey guys, you know, come be in this video. Tim, come sing. There were two or three things that I didn't have a hand in. That's one of them. And one was the Kiss the Girl. They didn't even invite me. You know, I wasn't part of it. It was the tracks were done, and we were a guest act, so the singers were on it, you know. But I was in the video, and well, the cool thing was after the band broke up, I was a staff writer for the publishing company that Doug had an interest in. So I got to write with Bill Engvall and Jeff and never sat in a room with them. But I wrote a bunch of music for Bill. There's like whole albums he did where I wrote most of the songs, two or three, and a Christmas record. And I wrote a couple of Foxworthy things that came out later that weren't as big as the Party thing or his early stuff. But very cool. We would just kind of send stuff back and forth. They'd send me the comedy bed, and Doug would tell me what they wanted, and I would write the music.
Yeah, like whatever, like, I guess, like, you know, late 90s equivalency of Zoom calls now, basically. Like I said, I was watching that Party All Night video, and like I remember that on CMT, and I remember that being played, and you know, like my parents probably had that CD and everything, and you know, going back now and looking at it and realizing that like Weird Al is the one who directed that music video. Now, I don't think you guys were necessarily like in the video other than like being broadcast on the TV, but yeah, that's one of those, that's interesting.
I didn't even know that. We just did our part like during a rehearsal.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we were rehearsing for an arena type Tim McGraw thing and set up this big setup. So Doug, ever being resourceful, hey, let's bring in a camera crew and get you guys there. So yeah, I didn't know that.
Oh, good old Wikipedia. You know, you mentioned being a staff writer and transitioning into that, and you had a couple of cuts with other artists and everything. What was that like getting, you know, after the band kind of disbanded and really starting to embrace more of those songwriting style side, as far as, you know, pitching songs to other artists and stuff?
I had been exposed to it somewhat just because we were always with Hamstein Music. Mm-hmm. So I'd gotten songs pitched that we weren't cutting, but definitely when the band broke up, it was my focus. You know, what are you doing now? I'm going to be a staff writer. Man, it took off right at first. It looked very promising right at first. And then just, I hit a wall. I got cuts, but nothing was ever singled. So it never took off. And I have tremendous admiration for the guys that can make a living doing that, being staff writers. It's as much as it gets mentioned, you know, in interviews and every once in a while, you know, it's part of the CMA, the Song of the Year and stuff like that. The publishing machine here and the staff writing thing is not well known, you know, but it, especially then, was what made this town run. You know, was a huge part. So you learn a lot. You learn a lot about studios going all the time and all the people doing demos and all the song pluggers and all that stuff. Fascinating world. Great, great guys. I loved co-writing and stuff. It was very frustrating. I had a song that was put on hold, which means they are going to cut it, you know, or want to. It's going to make the final list. It was on hold with, like, Patty Loveless, Hank Jr., Travis, Tim, Trace. We were told by different producers and label people, this song is a collaboration, and it's huge. This could be like a, you know, collaboration of the year kind of thing. We're doing it. And the last minute, nobody would do it. So that song was like, ugh, I'm done with this. If I could get back in the band and go work this amount of dates and they pay me when I get home, that's what I want to do. So I staff wrote some more after that. But really, you know, got back into playing live, and that became my main income, you know, and my main. So, because that's a tough way to live, man, because it's a great job if you could get it kind of thing. If you can get things cut and get things in the pipeline, then it's the best job in this town, I think. If you're not getting cuts, then you got to go play live again or whatever, you know. Oh, I had things. I had two songs on Trace Atkins' Big Time album. I had one on Montgomery Gentry's first record. I had Jeff Carson, David Kirsch, all kind of Ricochet. It wasn't a total bust, but Dwayne and I, nobody knows this hardly, we wrote a song with John Oates during that time that got, it was a top five, I believe, AC record for Hall & Oates. So I've got writing credits and got, you know, still seeing some stuff from that.
Yeah, actually, I have that written down here. I was going to ask how that was even, how that even came to be.
I'm a publishing company. Ham Steen, Bill Ham, is ZZ Top, you know, basically considered a fourth member sort of thing, and had a publishing company, and they had ties in that world, you know. And John Oates was actually in town writing with a bunch of staff people in town. I think he still does. He made friends back then. And I never got in a room with him again, but Dwayne and I spent a great morning with him. And left a typical, you know, 1 o'clock after lunch, thinking we got half a song, kind of, probably never get back. Oh, man, I wrote with John Oates. About a year later, I get a call. My wife comes in and hands me the, you know, rotary phone, or, you know, the real phone, and puts her hand over the thing and says, it's John Oates. I was like, holy shit, it's John Oates. Okay. And John says, hey, I just wanted you to know that we put Daryl on the song because he didn't just rock star it. He did a lot, and it's different. And he and I cut it for our new record. And I had heard they had, but I hadn't heard much about it. And I said, great, man. It's cool. I hope it, you know, sees the light of day. He goes, it's a smash. I said, well, great. I look forward to hearing it. He goes, no, it debuted at 27 on the AC charts. It's a smash. I was like, oh, that's why you're calling me. I didn't know that. My team didn't know that. And then I heard it, and it gave me chills, man, because it's like one of the last songs that I've heard that they recorded that sounds like vintage Hall & Oates. Got the background vocals in the whole. It's so them. And it did have that radio success and everything. So just one morning with him, and then Daryl reworked it. Next thing we know, we got a big old AC hit.
You know, you mentioned, you know, playing the six nights a week and being in a band or in a van and, you know, having a couple of vans, and then eventually, you know, you move into that bus. What was it like as far as, you know, just playing like bigger shows and playing these shows with bigger acts and being on quote unquote, you know, t-shirt tours, you know, like having that kind of thing, transitioning into that. What was that like as far as going into that? And was there ever like that realization, like, oh yeah, we have moved up, or what was that like?
It was very profound for us. The 90s were awesome because, like, I've heard people say Nashville was printing money. It was on. There wasn't such a, good luck, kid. It was like, find me another act. We need another hit. There's room. You know, it was a very on time. So we went from having one single to opening for Clint Black. And it's what you would think. That was the dream. You know, we went from playing six nights a week in a club and going back to that club and seeing our audience turned away at the door. There were fire codes being broken all through that first tour because we were on the road. We did like 300 dates. If you read our bio stuff, that's something everybody keys on. Because we had all these connections. We'd already been sort of a club band, so we went back to a lot of them. Young Men's Game, we were up for it. Got on that old stinky bus that broke down all the time, but at least it wasn't a van. And, Mike, I have clothes that still smell like diesel, you know, like a radio station T-shirt or something. Like, oh, yeah, that was on that first 30-foot American Eagle, which is not industry standard today. And played, you know, five nights a week in one-nighters all over the place in dive bars that were just packed with screaming girls. It was definitely like, oh, yeah, I see, you know, this is going on. And then halfway through all that, they landed us that baby slot on that Clint Black tour. So we went from 500 people, you know, 1,000 people a night to 1,200 in sheds and theaters and all that. Arenas, hockey arenas with him. Just what you'd think. That part, you know, there's a lot of careful what you wish for in this business, but that part was exciting and fun as you would think, you know, watching it catch fire and just every crowd be bigger and everybody excited about it. And there are these milestone shows. I remember there was a show in North Carolina somewhere near Raleigh at a basketball gym. And man, it was like New Kids on the Block. You left. Our sound man said you could not hear you guys. He said the crowd was 110 dB, and I couldn't mix you guys above the screams, you know. Mm-hmm. And those back then, it would be regular date, something crazy like that. They would tell you, okay, this is going to the next level, you know. Fun times.
Yeah, you know, like when you. I guess like every level that you jump up, there's a little bit more of the structure and like having, not necessarily like be on time, that kind of stuff, but it feels like all the time of the day is scheduled out way more and you have less wiggle room. What was that like? What was realizing that, you know, your time was being divvied up to other things other than just free time? If you will.
Shocking. Absolutely shocking. You do not think, you said t-shirt level or whatever, t-shirt gigs, you know, arena type things. You don't realize, you don't think about, you're about to become the CEO of a t-shirt company, you know, and deal with all that stuff. It was shocking. There was a meeting all the time. The amount that you had to see radio back then that you went and did was. And we were all for it. We loved it. And we're known as a very, very radio friendly, you know, these six long hairs come in having a ball with, you know, there's somebody for everybody kind of thing. When you're in a band like that, it was fun, but you just did not realize how much of your time was going to be taken up. It was like, wait a minute, this is this, you know, what? We have a day off and we don't have a day off anymore. Cause we got to go see, our CDs get packaged in a warehouse and talk to those people and play for them, which was great, but you just didn't know. I didn't know it was coming. I remember getting a schedule and it passed out a schedule one day. We were in the Dallas area and I held it up and said, lunch, there's no, you guys left out eat again. There's no time to eat. And like, I will get a pizza sent in at wherever, you know. It was really like that. It was crazy.
Yeah,
and I think that led to, you know, I saw all those, you've seen all the VH1 Behind the Music, you know, where Bon Jovi was worn out. We weren't near that big and we weren't as worn out, but it wears you down if that's all you're doing. If there's one thing you could do differently, it would be to space out the dates more. And I think they do now. When you really hit, you're doing much bigger, but less. I think that could be wrong, but we just went back then, man, when you had it going, you know, you made hay while the sun was shining kind of thing. It's just the way it was done. And it wore us out. And we didn't know all that was coming.
Yeah. It's related also, like you can apply it to what you were talking about with the song pluggers and all that kind of stuff. The world is that, you know, yeah, there's six of y'all in the band, but then there's just the iceberg analogy. Of,
yeah.
Like there's just so many people working that have jobs that you didn't know were a job.
Yeah.
You know, and as much as like you guys are able to be worn ragged, they're putting those hours in too.
Yeah, to this day, if you want to get your head chewed off, make fun of an act that somebody works for where they like the act. Mm-hmm. They'll come get you. Like, no, because they know the people. You know, they know how hard they've worked and know what it's about. And it's like, rah, 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 don't you be making fun of them, you know?
No, absolutely.
Like, oh, okay. When we see people we went through the battle with back then, man, it's huge hugs. I may see somebody from the industry. Hey, dude, you know, whatever. You see somebody that was in your on your team back then, you ain't seen them in 20 years, it's still like huge hugs. Like you went through something huge together, you know. Like, and you know each other so well, even though you haven't kept up, you know. There's a bond there from having gone through that, like having won a Super Bowl or something, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's been really, really great talking with you today. Thank you so much for coming on and telling some stories and some giving some insight.
Thanks for having me. We do so many interviews through the years where, you know, to keep it in little, you know, sound bites and say the talking points. It's fun just to be able to ramble, you know, relive some of this stuff. Great questions. Enjoy talking to you.
Okay, that just about does it for episode 4 of the Neon Eon. Thank you for listening, and a big thank you to Porter for the conversation. Again, subscribe, share, like, all that kind of stuff if you haven't just yet. And yeah, I'll see y'all next week for another episode of the Neon Eon.